few days ago, the final hammer dropped, and a bunch of corporate douchebags made the decision that Sports Illustrated would cease printing. And because douchebags got a douche, you'll hear the talk about how much the douchebags respect the brand, and how much the douchebags will continue to honor the legacy of Sports Illustrated, and how the douchebags believe in the power of journalism. But nah, they're douchebags. The guys at Authentic Brands Group, the guys at Arena Group, lame, wealthy, almost entirely white men who never cared about the legacy and only cared about swimsuit issue parties and selfies with Shaq and Snoop Dogg. And yeah, print is dead. There's no question. But the douchebags, it'd be one thing if they took delight in slamming the final nail into Sports Illustrated's coffin. But it's far worse than that. They gaze downward into the casket, spit on the corpse, and fucking grinned. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Cora Hall, the outstanding Tennessee women's basketball beat writer for the Knoxville News Sentinel. This is episode number 356. Let's sing some Yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigma's armpit.
All right, Cora, I complimented, actually I insulted where you're sitting by saying you look like you're in a sparsely furnished apartment, and you corrected me immediately and said, number one, it's a house, and number two, it's a nice house. I'm just looking at the most boring wall. So I'd like to start by apologizing. I did not mean to insult the wall you were sitting before.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. I love this house. So I wanted to make sure it got its credit.
Let's start here for a minute. You're a very young journalist. You graduated Ferris State in 2021. You cover Tennessee women's sports for the Knoxville News Sentinel. You are from Lansing, Michigan. You moved to Tennessee. It's been a long time since I've done this. I don't know. Is the first thing you do find a spot to live? Like, how do you even find your groundwork and your footing when you just start this new beat straight out of college?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I had actually never been to Knoxville before I moved here. Like, I had driven through because I have family in Atlanta and we would like drive from Michigan to Atlanta. But we had like never stopped here. And it was actually like really that I feel like finding housing is the hardest part of any time. Like, you get a new job because you just have no idea where to look or, you know, what's a good area to live in. And so I was like scouring these like apartment listings and like joining housing groups. And then my family in Atlanta, this is actually really funny, my older cousin had dated this girl for like 3 or 4 years, and her cousin owned a house in Knoxville. And she happened to be moving out of this house and moving to New York, and she needed somebody to fill her spot. And there was another girl living there too. And the timing was like, I got here like maybe 2 weeks before she was moving out. And I found this because my cousin's family is still really close with that family of the girl he dated. And so it was the most random connection ever. And I ended up getting to live in a house right away, which is amazing because I don't think I could do apartments here. They're so small.
So when you invite people over, do you tell people, come over to my house?
No, I think this is actually the third house I've lived in, and I have a horrible habit of moving every year and I hate it. But I usually, because I know the person who's owned each house, would be like, oh, like, come over to blank's house. Like, I'll be like, oh, come over to Katie's house. Like, it's not my house. So I like will call it by the person who owns it.
I started my career in Nashville at the Tennessean. You're starting your career in Knoxville at the New Sentinel. And there's something you do that I really dig, which is you cover, for example, Tennessee women's basketball as women's basketball. And what I mean is, I think in the past there was this thing, just cover it like you'd cover a men's team. You know, just cover, if you're covering women, best tip I can give you, cover it just like it's a men's team. And I actually think you do the opposite of that. And a couple of stories that I was just reading here, they're great. How a head coach balances being a mom, about Kelly Harper, the Tennessee women's basketball coach, and balancing being a mom and a coach. Criticized for lashes and nails, Black women's basketball players embrace self-expression. I just think it seems to me that you do not look at this beat as comparable to covering a men's team. You view it as its own little unique universe. But tell me if I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, I think there's like kind of a mix, right? Because obviously, like, I want to give the women's team you know, the same like level of depth of coverage as the men's team. But I think it's also a unique thing where there aren't a ton of women's basketball teams that have writers dedicated specifically to them. I think where I've gone to that point wasn't necessarily like fully intentional, but I think just as I got more immersed in like the women's basketball like community and like the fans, a lot of women's basketball fans are women's basketball fans in general. Like, and there's obviously like they have their specific teams and they're fans of a team, but I feel like a lot of women's basketball fans are just fans of the sport as a whole. And I think especially with like Tennessee fans historically, like with Pat Summitt and how much she grew the game, and like they care a lot about women's basketball as a whole. And I think there's so much that can get missed just because there aren't a lot of full-time women's basketball beat writers across the country, that I think like anytime I have the opportunity to kind of bring a more national lens to it or expand past like where we are in Knoxville is important. And I think people have enjoyed it.
Do you have to think of covering women differently than you think of covering men's sports?
I don't know. That's a good question. Like I haven't covered a lot of men's sports. I mean, in college I did, but like, I don't think I was really thinking about it that deeply in college. I don't know. I think that's a good question. I think sometimes you do. I think there's a lot of opportunities in women's basketball for intersectionality and having to bring that into the discussion where, and more people are willing to do that and want to do that than maybe in men's sports. Or just men's sports coverage is so established in the way that it's been done for so long that it's like, this is just how it's done. And there's like this, not formula, but there's this definitely more commonalities in the way men's sports are covered across the board, I think. And I think just with the lack of women's sports coverage, there's more opportunity to kind of create a new space in how we cover sports in a way. And I think that's like, I don't think you have to do it like that, but I think it's more interesting to do it like that in a way, if that makes sense.
Do you think being a woman, would it impact the way one covers a team? If I'm covering a women's basketball team as an example, do you feel like you, being a young woman and a woman, can relate to the players, cover them differently, cover them better than 51-year-old guy coming in and covering the same sport?
I think yes, to an extent. And I don't think not being a woman or a young woman would like mean you couldn't do a great job like covering this team, but I don't know many guys who would have gone after the story about the Black players who, you know, are embracing self-expression because of the, even though people are criticizing, you know, them wearing eyelash extensions and getting, you know, their nails done with like fake nails. I don't know if, you know, there's some guys on the beat. I don't know if they would have pursued that in the level that I did. So I think there are ways where like, I have a level of relatability with the players that is really nice. And there's maybe more of just like an immediate trust in some ways, but I don't think it means you can't do a great job. Cause obviously like I'm young, I'm learning. I've had to learn a lot about the topics I'm covering, if it's an issue that I'm kind of basing reporting on, and I didn't know everything coming into this. So I've also done a lot of learning and growing. And obviously I don't understand the perspective of Black players. Like I'm not Black, so I can't, you know, pretend like I know or will catch everything that they go through. So a lot of it's like being open to learning and really listening to just the different perspectives of the people you're covering. And I don't think it has to do wholly with like who you are.
All right, let's talk about that story a little. Criticized for lashes and nails, Black women's basketball players embrace self-expression, came out February 27, 2023. Lead: Jordan Walker grew up watching Skylar Diggins-Smith at Notre Dame. Diggins-Smith, a two-time first-team All-American, was one of the first prominent women's basketball players to embrace looking feminine on the court. Seeing a Black woman do that on a national stage had a lasting impact on Walker as a young Black player. She's so pretty and she just carries herself so nice and she looks so classy. But on the court, she does the same thing. The Tennessee Lady Vols guard remembered thinking, she still looks classy, looks put together, but she's a beast, you know? She can knock down shots, play defense, all of that. Chicago Sky point guard Dana Evans said Diggins-Smith, now a six-time WNBA All-Star, marked the beginning of a new generation of players, a generation of Black women who choose to be authentically themselves on the court. That's a really, really great piece about sort of self-expression and women feeling comfortable being themselves and expressing themselves. How'd you even come up with the idea?
This came about because one of the Tennesseans basketball players, Tamari Key, she was getting a lot of online harassment for having eyelash extensions, fake nails. And it was really kind of interesting because she was also struggling in some ways on the court, and people were really just going in on her online. And it turned out that she had blood clots in her lungs, which was holding her back on the court. And so, like, in the mix of all this, she's also facing harassment that was very, there was levels to it. It was very coded. Like, she's a Black woman on the court, and people are immediately going after her appearance. And so she made this post about the comments she had been getting and how, you know, it was her Black girl magic, and that she, you know, was embracing looking feminine on the court and having eyelash extensions, and it wasn't affecting her play, like actually having blood clots in her lungs were. But I really wanted to go deeper into that because there was a lot of stories about the post she made and like the incident itself. But I feel like writing kind of like a newser about that happening doesn't really give you space to dive into like the deeper issue here. And so I really wanted to follow up on it and talk to other basketball players, because obviously she's not the only one doing this. And there are a lot of highly successful basketball players who do have lashes, who do have fake nails, and they are amazing basketball players. It doesn't impact them. So this was one where I was like, I feel like we can go on a national scale and even into the pros, because Dana Evans was like a really big face of kind of that new generation of players who are going to look feminine on the court, who will embrace that. So that post happened in, I want to say, November of the season. And I worked on that all season because I was hoping to talk to Tamari about it, but she didn't really want to. And like, you know, the Tennessee communications people were like, we don't really want to put her through that again, because it was like really emotional. I totally got it. But Jordan Walker was her roommate, and she was also a graduate student. So she felt comfortable, you know, talking about it, helping me tie it in to the team specifically. But yeah, I was really proud of that. I thought it was really important to follow up on that, because I didn't want to let a moment like that pass without making an effort to like start an actual conversation about it and let players have a chance to, I don't know, explain themselves and like help people understand like another perspective of it and why it was a problem.
So way back in 1980, way before you were born, the Houston Astros had a pitcher named J.R. Richard, African-American pitcher. He was a star, and he started pitching poorly. And the team started saying he was slacking. He wasn't putting his all into it. He was lazy, everything, every trope. And it turns out he had a stroke. And that's why he wasn't pitching well. He ended up having a stroke and never pitching again. Here we are in 2024, Tamari Key. Do you feel like the tropes of Black players, they're just making excuses, just being lazy? Oh, she's so difficult, blah, blah, blah. Is that still way heavy on sports?
I think it's definitely still prevalent. And I think you see, like, I mean, I've seen a lot in women's basketball. Like, there are still, like, you know, the worst of fan bases calling South Carolina players thugs and bar fighters and like literally every, you know, everything in the book. And there's also a lot of like coded language where it's not as obvious. And you're like, well, okay, really shouldn't be talking about Black players like this. Like, that's very underhandedly racist. I am thinking of when South Carolina played at UConn last year, and it was a pretty physical game, but like most are. And Gino Auriemma got up in the post-game press conference and said like one of his players was getting beat up and like, this isn't basketball anymore. And he said that after playing a, like a predominantly Black team who, like, I felt like South Carolina got a lot of that and has gotten a lot of that. And, you know, Don Saley responded, and it was this whole thing because like that was very coded language to use after just a regular, pretty regular basketball game. So I think you see it at different levels throughout the sports still. Sometimes it's harder to, like, it's not as overt sometimes, but sometimes it is.
Is it an issue that you feel comfortable delving into? Again, you're a pretty young writer. You're writing for a fairly large newspaper. You're covering a pretty major team in sports. Is it comfortable for you at this point in your career to be like, I'm going to delve into race in sports, I'm going to delve into racial attitudes in players, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Or does it feel a little bit still like a time bomb?
I feel like I'm comfortable doing it. I don't know if like maybe saying I'm completely comfortable doing it is the right way to say it, but it doesn't make me uncomfortable. And that's because I'm really intentional about making sure that I let my reporting really speak for itself. Like, I'm not out here inserting my opinions into these pieces about race, because obviously like a lot of it in basketball has to do with Black women, which I am not. So like, that's not really my place, but I really feel passionate about if players would like to speak on these things, to give them a place to do that. And I also think it's important to like not have toxic positivity in women's basketball in a way of like, oh, everything's great and we're just growing the sport and this isn't that, and just like ignoring the problems that still exist. So I think like for me, it's like, I don't think I would do a good job covering women's basketball if I wasn't thinking about opportunities where we have to talk about race, or opportunities present itself where like you need to talk about race in this instance or this issue. Like, I don't think you can fully do a great job covering women's basketball if you don't do that.
When you're covering college athletes, like a good example, Tamari Key, she's a pretty important part of the story. You make an effort to talk to her, it's a no. With college sports, do you just have to say like, okay, or are you allowed to try multiple times? Are you allowed to text the athlete? Are you allowed to try hitting her up on Instagram? Or is it a hard no from the beginning?
I don't get refused for interviews often in college athletics, because it's kind of like, I don't know, there aren't really that many instances where like a player would refuse an interview. So when it does happen, I usually am pretty respectful of that. Because also, like, I don't want to get a no and then try to go around like the SID and then make it feel like I'm trying to go over him or under whatever. Like, and that's going to, you know, hurt my relationship with other people in the department. So like, it's kind of like this balance of like, can we do the story? You get a no. Can you do the story without it? In this case, yes, I definitely can. It'd probably be a better story if it wasn't like, oh, I really want to focus on her and like how this like, you know, was so hard for her. And it's like, that's kind of like, we don't have to do that. We can just broaden it to the topic itself and like have a really meaningful discussion about the issues within this incident instead of detailing how difficult this was for her and how emotional and blah, 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 because that's not really like moving the conversation. So in that case, I was like, it's not like worth it to really push the issue on this one. I can see instances where you would need to, and like where you do need to like talk to players for a certain story. Maybe you just can't do that, but usually I tend to respect the no's because it doesn't happen too often.
The Tennessee Sports Information Department, Eric Traynor handles women's basketball. He's been around a long time. Do you, reporter covering Tennessee women's basketball, need to have a good relationship with him?
I think your relationships on the beat always matter. I think I have a good relationship with Eric. I've tried to, you know, be in good communication with him just so he feels like, you know, he can trust me. And I think we've built a good relationship. And I do think that's important, because at the end of the day, I mean, the SIDs are, you know, setting up your interviews and like, they're not the gatekeepers, but, you know, it's important to have a good relationship with them, especially because, you know, just have conversations with them on the side and like, in some other sport, not women's basketball, but like in like other sports, you know, they might just slide you some information and that might be helpful. So I think it's good to like have a good relationship with SIDs. And Eric he's been here for a long time doing this. So it's not someone I'm trying to have a bad relationship with also.
Have you pissed off the athletic department yet?
Adam Sparks handles a lot of our like NCAA investigation and, you know, that stuff. So I'm sure he might have, but I don't think I have yet, as far as I know.
You wrote a piece, How a Head Coach Balances Being a Mom, came out earlier this year. Your lead was Jackson and Kylie Harper were already on the court when the Lady Vols started trickling out of the locker room for warmups. When Tennessee basketball coach Kelly Harper followed, Kylie abandoned what she was doing and ran to her. Harper sat down in the front row along the baseline at Thompson Boiling Arena at Food City Center, and Kylie 5 jumped in her lap. Harper wrapped her daughter in a hug. Kylie, wearing her mom's number 14 Lady Vols jersey, sat there for a minute before hopping off Harper's lap, not wanting to sit still. She grabbed a ball and showed her mom that she could sort of dribble behind her back. Harper gave her tips between attempts, and Kylie returned periodically to her mom's lap for a hug and a whisper of message. It's usually only about 5 minutes or so, but Harper sits there before every home game with Kylie and Jackson, though 10-year-old Jackson is usually rebounding for players nowadays. Sometimes it's the first time Harper gets to see her children on game days, and they're 5 important minutes. Okay, really good story. So Kelly Harper, women's basketball coach, is about 23 years older than you are. And she's a former Tennessee player. She's been around. She's bounced around to different coaching jobs. When you take over this beat, how do you establish a relationship with her? And is it important that you have a relationship with her?
Yeah, I think it is important to have a relationship with a head coach. And when I first got here, like, this is obviously like my first beat ever. So I'm just like trying to figure out what to do and what I'm supposed to do and how to approach covering a team. But I think where that relationship building comes in is like when I get her on the phone one-on-one, you know, like just and showing up every day. Like I think showing up and doing a good job goes a really long way, especially with women's sports where it's like you don't always get that coverage. So at the beginning, it was kind of just like showing up, doing a good job, asking thoughtful questions and making sure that you're prepared. So that way, you know, coaches notice when you ask good questions and you are actually prepared to do your job. So at first it was just kind of like making sure I got some one-on-ones with her so we could like talk about, you know, whatever story. And then, you know, I might ask her things that, you know, this is for the story, but hey, wanted to ask about this. And then my second year, I got to have kind of more casual interactions with her because they were still doing Zoom press conferences for away games. And in order for like to go travel, like I needed some more access. And she was totally willing to let me do that and come to like a shoot around or like film just so I could get something extra to like make the travel worth it. And so I would, you know, I'd shoot around if I could pull her for a couple minutes and just chat about whatever. That also helps to build a relationship where it's like, not every time we've talked, I need something from you. But I also think just like with Kelly, like doing a good job and being fair, like goes a long way with her as well. It's something that builds as you're here for a while. Cause at first, like I definitely was just like, I'm just trying to do my job right. And I wasn't thinking of, oh, how can I build a good relationship with Kelly? But now I think it's just kind of built to the point where like, you know, I think there's a good relationship there and she appreciates how I do my job and the way I cover their team.
You get hired by this newspaper. You've never been in the town. You don't know where you're going to live. And it's basically like, you're covering women's sports. Welcome to the city. Go get them.
Yeah. I originally talked to them about the high school running position that was open. And I basically just talked their ear off about covering women's sports and how I really wanted to do that and how much I loved it in Kansas City covering the NWSL team. And they didn't have a beat writer at the Star. So like as the intern, I got to like basically be kind of a beat writer for the NWSL team, which was awesome. And just really kind of created this passion in covering women's sports for me. So I like talked about that to the editors and they were like, oh, well, I think you might actually be a really good fit for covering Lady Vols. And we really want someone to like kind of re-energize this beat and like revamp it. And we want someone who's passionate about it. So yeah, I was like, you know what? I don't know if I would move to Knoxville to cover high school sports, but I would move to Knoxville to cover women's sports. So sign me up.
Wait, so you just show up in town. How many days were you there before you started?
I got there like only a few days before I started. I was staying like in an Airbnb because I couldn't get in my house yet. And I was like just driving here. I was like, I have no idea where anything, like where to eat, like where to go. Like and it was like, all right, cool. Now you're going to go start covering. And it was nice because I could start off covering soccer to get my feet wet a little bit. And then basketball season was here like immediately after that. So because I started in September. So that was like pretty close to the basketball starting. And then I was just like sucked into the season. And I just was like, all right, I'm here.
What are the adjustments one has to make besides the obvious ones? Where am I going to live? Like, are you getting lost driving places? Like, do you have any clue what you're doing? Are you pouring over the rosters and trying to figure out who's who? Like, what is that even like?
Me and my Apple Maps were really good friends the first month I lived here, but then I feel like I'm pretty good with directions. So I got the hang of things pretty quickly. But like me just like putting in Thompson Bowling Arena, how to get there, like every, you know, couple of weeks until I learned my route there. But I think preparing for a beat's really hard because you can like look through the roster and where these players are from and you know, read stories, but like until you're just there and like you get to interact with them and you're watching games, like you can only know so much. I didn't know deep knowledge of the Lady Vols program when I got here. Like I knew, you know, obviously of it, past summit and things like that. But like, I didn't know like a lot. A lot of that first season for me was just like diving into the history of the program. Whenever there was a chance to like, when Stanford came to town, I set up an interview, talked to Tara Vanderveer for a little bit, did a short story on her and Pat Summit's relationship. So like there were these opportunities to like learn that history along the way, which is really helpful for me to like get into that and do that. Cause now I feel like I have a great handle on, you know, the history of the program and stuff. But when I first got here, I definitely didn't. So that was also kind of more part of it for me too, was, you know, yeah, learn the players and try to get at least a baseline before you go into the season, but also learning the history of the program with, you know, obviously the coach being someone who played here and won 3 national championships here and things like that.
You were but a youngin when Pat Summit coached her last game at Tennessee. You were a youngin when Pat Summit died. Again, when I was at the Tennessean, Pat Summit was a, you know, already a Mount Rushmore type figure in Tennessee sports. That program for a long span was the dominant women's basketball program. Then it was one of the dominant programs. And now it feels like a good program. How much does Pat Summit and the ghost of Pat Summit loom over Tennessee women's basketball?
That's a good question. I feel like it was more my first season because that was Kelly's third season and they were like playing really well and people were like, oh my gosh, Kelly Harper has, you know, led them back to the top. She played for Pat Summit. And like, there was just more, I feel like there was more like focus around that. And it was, I think it's hard too, because, you know, so many of the fans from this fan base, Pat Summit is why they became fans and they loved her and there's never going to be anyone like her again. And there's such high expectations. And then, I mean, last year when we were leading up to the UConn-Tennessee matchup, like College Game Day was going to be here because of the historic rivalry. And so like, there's never not going to be, you know, the presence of Pat Summit with around this program. But I also think it has gotten to be less, I think, since then, just because at a certain point, like you have to give Kelly Harper space to do what she needs to do and not feel like she has to do it exactly the way Pat did it, or, you know, have the same expectations for her as you had for Pat. I don't know. It's been interesting because I feel like it was more so my first season and it's kind of been not as much since then. And I don't know if that's just from my perspective, but I mean, you still get coaches like when we were at Ole Miss, Coach Yeo was talking about how every time, you know, she plays Tennessee, she feels Pat Summit's spirit. And then they played 2 former Lady Vol head coaches this season. So when Bridget Gordon was in town and when Alex Simmons was in town, like, you know, there was discussions around, oh, coming back and playing for Pat and things like that. But I think it has gotten less over the last few seasons.
I don't even know because I live so far away. What is the level of passion these days for Tennessee? Like, again, when I was there, the women's program was significantly bigger than the men's program. Is that still the case? Are people still diehards about it, or is it leveled off a little bit?
There's definitely people who are still diehards about it. I think the men's program has gained a lot of popularity just with like their success. So I think it's definitely a lot more even than it probably used to be. But I mean, there's still like so many diehard Lady Vol fans here. They had like 15,000 against LSU, which was also the biggest crowd since like 2015. So it kind of comes in waves, I feel like, too, because if the team is playing really well, like more people are going to show up. If they don't, less people are going to show up. So I think it's a little more dependent on success now. And the men's program is definitely very, very popular right now.
You wrote a piece, came out November 1st. And this is after Nikki McCray had died. And Nikki McCray was a fantastic former Tennessee basketball player who went on to coach. The story was headlined, "How Lady Vols Honor McCray, Penson, and Butts. There are 2 small black patches on the chest of every Lady Vols basketball player's warm-up. The one has a letter NM sewn on it, the other TB. They are in honor of former Lady Vols Nikki McCray Penson and Tasha Butts, both of whom died of breast cancer in the past 4 months. The patches are small yet poignant reminders of 2 women who helped shape the Tennessee program under Pat Summit." This is a really lovely piece talking about them and how they're being honored. Here's a weird question for you. Does the 20-year-old Tennessee point guard give a shit that Nikki McCray died or Tasha Butts died? Does it ever feel like, in a way, you're force feed? Like, so how do you feel about Nikki McCray dying? Like, you're asking some young woman who wasn't even alive when Nikki McCray was a star. Do they care, or is it just a story that needs to be written because that's what we do?
I think Tennessee does a really good job of making sure their players understand the history of the program. And there are a lot of alums who will come back. So I do think they care. I think there are some times when, like, it can be not necessarily about, like, these players in particular, but, like, talking about, like, what the program used to be or, like, the history of the program. Like, sometimes they're like, yeah, like, I get the feeling that this, you know, the players now, like, they're less and less connected to it. But I do think when an alumni dies, I think they really did care and they do know the history of this program and how important the players were who came before them. Like, that's something that Kelly is really big on. And also Rekia Jackson, who is their star player, she actually played for Nikki McCray at Mississippi State for the season that she coached as head coach there. So that was deeply personal to her and really hard for her to talk about. I believe she got asked about it after that first game and, like, she couldn't really finish her answer because she was getting really emotional. So there was, like, one player who had, like, a personal connection to Nikki McCray.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey. And what is that on your ankle?
It's a tattoo of a boot.
You got a tattoo of a boot on your ankle? Young lady, you're only 19 years old.
Dad, calm down. It's not just any boot.
I am so angry.
Dad, it's the kicking shoe worn by Garrett Lindholm, kicker for the 2011 Milwaukee Mustangs of the Arena Football League. I wanted to let people know they can go to royalretros.com and buy a hand-stitched, made-with-love Mustangs jersey.
Ugh, did you really have to get a tattoo to do this?
The butt-piercing pavilion was closed.
As we mentioned, you attended Ferris State. Very, very strong Division II football program. You wrote a piece for the Ferris State Torch, the student newspaper, back in 2020, editor's column, the year of YouTube graduations. And he wrote on March 13th, 2020, I couldn't have imagined what the next 365 days would hold. A year ago today, I thought we would be back to normal by the time school started, and there'd be no way I'd be missing out on an in-person graduation. Now, if you offered me an in-person graduation, I don't think I would even consider it. Last week, I went to the University Center for our graduation fair to pick up my diploma sleeve and a cap and gown for photos, all to watch my graduation on YouTube. I picked up my cords and bought myself an alumni sticker and sweatshirt as if I needed another to add to my Ferris collection. There's a strange dissonance between picking up graduation regalia like it was any other year, only to wear it in our living room with my family. It's a weird contrast to hear that a friend's college graduation in Missouri is going with an in-person ceremony when we've assumed since the fall we wouldn't have a chance. It's extraordinary how much your perspective can change in a year. Think back to your mindset a year ago. To even recognize the way you were thinking. I truly had no idea what to expect when then precautionary lockdowns were being enforced. I did not expect it to take so many lives, so many experiences and life events until now. I went from being one of the most extroverted people of my friends to an introverted homebody. I feel like I've been working around the clock all school year during pandemic. Like many people I know, I'm exhausted. Seriously, great college column. Do you feel like you were robbed of something from your college experience?
Well, first, thank you. You said the date of that and I was like, oh God, like, what is he going to read? Cause like, I feel like every time I look back at what I've written before, I cringe a little bit, but that one was okay. I do feel like I always have such an interesting time trying to like wrestle with that because I was very lucky in the fact that like, I didn't have people close to me die from COVID-19. And like my life wasn't tragically impacted like so many people's were. But I also do think it's important for like people to acknowledge the way that this impacted everybody. And it's really interesting because when the lockdowns hit, I was literally not in the country. I was studying abroad in the Netherlands and I was supposed to be there all semester. And I had been there for about 6 weeks when the US shut down. And so then there was like this period of like, am I staying? Am I going? I want to stay. My parents want me to come home. And they're like, well, what if you get stuck there? And I was like, well, I'm supposed to be here till June. So who cares? And so it was like, I ended up coming home for 6 weeks. I was stuck in my room. I was miserable. And then my parents were like, well, like, if you want to go back, you can go back. So I ended up going back because like all my friends were there and I had a residence card so I could go back whenever I wanted. And it was awesome. Like I honestly really enjoyed being able, we had online classes, we couldn't travel, we were like stuck, but like it was like the most simple time of my life. We would just go to online class and then it'd be like beautiful and sunny outside and we'd bike downtown and get food and then go sit in like the fields behind our apartment. And I didn't have a job because I was studying abroad. And it was so strange to be in like, it wasn't like a bubble because there were still restrictions, but like everywhere, like the US, shit was hitting the fan. Like I felt like every other week. And I was just like here in the Netherlands with my friends eating a sandwich outside at the picnic table. But we couldn't travel. I was in a journalism program and I was supposed to do a 2 week trip to a different country and do like all this reporting. And we didn't get to do that. But I still had, and I miss the tulips. The one thing I was like potentially most excited about, I went home right before they bloomed and I got back right after they were like all dying. And then I missed it. So one day I want to go back and see it. So yes, I do feel like I was robbed of certain things, but I also can't really complain about how things ended up for me.
You interned at the Kansas City Star, but you also interned at the Grand Haven Tribune. And I interned at the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. Like, I'm a huge fan. Everyone guns for the ESPN internship and the New York Times internship. There's something to be said for interning at the Grand Haven Tribune. And I just want to say, August 12th, 2019, strutting their sounds, over 40 local artists showcase their music at festival. Byline, Cora, lead. The east side of Grand Haven was filled with the sounds of 46 different bands on Saturday afternoon for this year's Walk of the Beat Music Festival. Muskegon native Brandon Martin called it an art prize for musicians, and the comparison fits with outdoor stages lining South Beach Street Street from Clover Bar all the way up to Fulton Street. This is a podcast, so they can't see you holding your hand over your mouth. But it seems like your stories that you wrote are just quaint piece after quaint piece after quaint piece. Nobody celebrates an armed service like the Coast Guard City, USA, and a tradition like no other. And senior community feels valued during festival, and snow skiers entertain waterfront crowd. It seems like the greatest internship ever in a lot of ways. Or am I being hokey and old?
It was, I can't believe you looked that up. It's funny because that was probably the only internship I was capable of getting at that point in my career. Like I'm at Ferris State. It's kind of a journalism program, but like no one is going to give a student from Ferris State with no other internship experience an internship. So that was my like, I just need to get an internship because I'm never going to get a bigger one if I don't do this. And being on like the, it was like a, it's a mid-sized campus, but Big Rapids, where Ferris State is a very small town. So I really did think there was value in like, you know, small town reporting. And I was like, I'm gonna learn a lot regardless. Obviously, it's not like a flashy internship, but like it was fun. It was a really small newsroom, but like I really got to see like the day-to-day of what it takes to run a small town newspaper. And I did stories that, you know, like the ones you read off. It's a quaint story after quaint story, and like it's doesn't feel like the most important journalism in the world, but it's important for that city. It's a town on the coast of Lake Michigan, so great spot to be for the summer. So I couldn't really complain. But yeah, it was, I did a lot of stuff that I didn't think I would do. Like I'm driving here for some ceremony in the middle of a state park. And like it just, there were so many experiences that you would only get like at a small town reporting job.
And everyone's happy to see you.
Yeah, everyone's so appreciative of what you're doing and so excited to talk to you about quilts they're making or the festival that's coming to town that happens every single year with the same exact things every single year. But it's like the biggest thing of the summer. So they're excited to talk about it.
I have a curveball question for you. I came up in 1994, and let's say I went to the Tennessean to interview. And I had like nose rings, and you have two nose rings, right?
Yes.
My parents would be like, take those out. They're never going to blah, blah, blah. Or if I had like tattoos, they'd be like, cover your tattoos, blah, blah, blah. There we go. Of course, showing off the, what do we got there?
A phrase in Korean that means basically like families forever and some cherry tree blossoms.
In this modern era, do you have to think about that at all? I'm actually being serious. You go for an interview in Knoxville, blah, blah, blah. Are you considering in your Zoom interview, because you didn't go to Knoxville, taking the metal out of your nose or blah, blah, blah? Or is it just, we're just so past that, who cares?
It's interesting because I only had phone interviews. So like they didn't even see my face when we were interviewing. So I didn't really have to worry about that. But also like, I don't know if I would have thought about that. I think I also only had one nose piercing at the time. And I don't think I was wearing a hoop. So it was just like a stud. Like, I don't think I would have been like, oh, I need to take this out. Like, it's been like, I don't know. Like, this is the Gen Z in me that I'm like, whatever. Like, if you don't want to hire me because of my nose ring, I probably don't want to work for you anyways. And I also just don't think people care as much anymore. And maybe there are places that care, but like, I think journalism is also a place where I can't really imagine somebody caring right now. Like, maybe if it was more of like a law office or something like that, I might think about it. I don't think I would think about that going into an interview right now.
I actually think the profession has changed dramatically. I think 30 years ago, if I had shown up for my interview with a nose piercing, it actually would have been a topic of discussion, which is obviously stupid. And I think nowadays, half the journalists you see either have some piercing or tats or blah, blah, blah. Nobody cares. But you need to take that out for this podcast, okay?
Okay, well, I'll run over there and do that real quick. Sorry.
You might be too young for this, but I'm required to ask. Have you pissed anyone off in your career?
In college, yes. I can't say it's happened since I graduated, but like in college, the actual president of my university disliked me. Like, he hated me, I think. And I also am pretty sure the athletic director was very not fond of me. And the president didn't like me because I had to cover when all the faculty were striking to start my sophomore year. And I would go to, you know, their picketing, and I would interview like the union president and like faculty about like what's going on and contract negotiations. And the president and his office declined to comment every time. I have never worked so hard to try to get a comment from somebody as that period of my life. I was emailing, calling, I showed up at his office. I tried to schedule meetings with him. I showed up to like an academic senate meeting where he was speaking at and waited for him to get done talking and tried to catch him out the door. And he's like, I'm not speaking to media. Cool. So I've done like every single effort to try to get you to comment and include your voice in your guys's side. And then you won't. And then you're mad at me because I'm only representing one side. And so ever since then, like, he was really not a fan of me. And then this is actually really funny. So Division II, most sports, the hockey team was D1, but there was very casual access. Like, I could just show up to football practice on Wednesdays and nobody cared. Watch the whole thing, do interviews after. It was a great training ground for me to just kind of figure out how to do this. And I got a ton of access. It was awesome. But I also knew a lot of the athletes. So like, I got scoops on stuff, and I was very like attentive to the news going around, and the athletic director would ask the SID, how did she know this? Where did she get this? Like, what do we do about this? And the SID was like a former Torch writer, and he was very supportive of student media. And he was like, well, you can't really do anything about it. And he later told me the athletic director made him keep a file labeled Cora of everything I was doing and like the stuff I was writing, and keeping tabs on me essentially, because I just kept writing stuff he didn't like or finding out stuff he didn't think was going to get found out. I don't know, but it was really funny to hear that there was a file with my name on it.
I don't want to one-up you, but when I was at the University of Delaware, the team gave the head men's soccer coach a dartboard with my photo on it.
That's awesome. No, you definitely win.
Let me ask you a final question. In 2019, you penned what must be considered a very important and Pulitzer-worthy story. Kids provide inspiration for GH Eatery. And your lead was, Grand Haven's East Side will be getting a bit of magic come December with the planned opening of the Unicorn Tavern. I just need to know, how's the Unicorn Tavern? Is it good and is it worth eating at?
I actually never got to go to it because it was delayed in opening, but I loved that story because it was so cool to talk to the owner, and he had been part of making a really popular restaurant that had a couple locations in Michigan, and the way he talked about his kids and everything like that was really, really cool. But I never got to go, even though like it sounds like such a cool concept. And like, every time I go home, I like think of, or I'm like in the area, I'm like, oh, like, I kind of want to go there and like see what it's like now, because I know they did eventually open. But yeah, I never got to go.
Well, Cora, listen, seriously, you're doing a great job. I love your transition. I love how you're covering this team. I just think it's really smart and savvy and inventive in a lot of ways. And I appreciate you doing this. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's been an honor for like I didn't think when I was like reading all the people who have been on this, I was like, I don't feel like I fit in. So I appreciate you having me on.
I want to thank today's guest, Cora Hall, for joining me on Two Riders Singing the Aim. You can follow Cora on Twitter at Cora Hall and read her work in the Knoxville News Sentinel. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing the Aim, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the amazing MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.